all of that personalization, I think, is like the core of what makes email such a special channel and what powers all that personalization is that data.
We have a fun conversation today about email marketing. We have two awesome members who work very heavily in this space and excited to pick their brains on this subject, Jess Chan and Melanie Balk. Awesome to have you guys here. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, good to be here.
Same, yeah.
If you guys don't mind, I'd love to do a quick little intro. You can keep it as quick and brief or as long as you want, just so people know what you do and why they should listen to you around email. Maybe Melanie, if you want to start.
Sure. I would like to start with a fun fact. Born and raised in Germany. That's why no one knows how to say my last name. But that's also where my career originally started, in like super traditional German industries, automotive, telecommunication, healthcare. And then I stumbled upon the startup project, fell in love with that, did a couple of other projects. And when I moved to the US, dove into e-com. So kind of like started as the first real marketing hire for this, besides the co-founder for this furniture brand, like the first furniture brand to be on e-com. And one of the big things that they, that I, when I came in and I like did the whole analysis that I suggested to them was to revamp the whole email program. So they said, go do it. And that was kind of like my first start in email. And then later I joined an agency also like super strategic actually, but they started selling email services to clients and they didn't really have an email department. And so they were like, go build it. And so I went and I built the email department. And after I left them, I was doing some, you know, freelance, like kind of like sort of outsourced CMO type of stuff. And again, email came back and people were like, can you do email for us? Can you do email from us? And so after reluctantly trying to escape from email, decided to build this email agency. And here we are.
Nice. And what is the name of the agency? What do you do?
We just pivoted to The Email Marketers. So it's theemailmarketers.com.
Advanced naming strategy. Yes, I like it.
Amazing.
We just had a call with a bunch of tech guys from California who were way too cute. And we were like, oh, this, you don't know what this is. That's very straightforward. I like it.
So you just kind of fell into it and got good at it. Now you can't escape it. Now that's what you do.
Yeah. And I like doing it. I think it's one of those channels that like makes a lot of sense if you're on e-com or if you're in marketing. And that is really fun because you get to build this real brand relationship with customers. So I love that about it.
Last question, I'll go to Jess. What is the like clientele you work with mostly in the agency?
So e-com, only e-com or 99% e-com. Yeah. And then a lot of within e-com, a lot of like food and beverage clients for whatever reason.
Cool. Got it. Cool.
Very good. So unlike Melanie, Jess Chan's been wanting to do email marketing since she was 5.
Totally.
Exactly. What as a young girl, dreamed of being an email marketer.
Actually, it's really similar background to Melanie as well. I was originally in actuarial science and economics. So that was kind of like my original background. And it was just like, you know what? Sending an insurance company cranking out spreadsheets is probably not in my future. So it was kind of just, you know, exploring a few different routes and then ended up working with Kat and Alan at Best Self as a marketing assistant when I was still in college. So I did that like kind of part-time in the beginning. And I still remember, like, I think the first task was like, hey, we want to do like a monthly email newsletter. I still remember Googling like how to e-com newsletter. And like, you know,
I completely forgot that's how we initially met. You came to Croatia because you've moved on to all this other stuff and I just blacked that part out.
Yeah, so I still very distinctly remember that like how to e-com newsletter, and I like threw together this like motivational Monday thing in like 20 minutes and sent that thing out, and it generated like just over 5K, and I still remember that like Klaviyo number so distinctly in my head because I was like in college and I was like, oh my god, I did this thing for 20 minutes, this is more money than I've ever seen in my life. Right. That's kind of the beginning, and then became their CMO and was running all of their marketing in-house, and then I kind of started on the email freelance side, just from going to events. I was kind of walking through like how we were doing email for Best Self, and then had a few kind of people reach out just saying like if I could like help them get everything set up on the side, and like walk them through it. So that was kind of how I got my first few clients. And it was always very like, just, you know, let me just see how this goes. Like, it was just like, hey, it was good cash flow for a little bit. And then same thing as Melanie, like originally it was, hey, let's do brand and content and email. And the email kept coming up and I'm like, okay, fine. Like, guess we're doing email. And then eventually left Best Self, started Long Play, which is my agency now. And that was, I guess, 2 years ago now. And now we have like a team of 22-ish, something like that. And it's been a wild adventure down the email route. And then now we just launched SMS as well. So we're kind of going deeper into the retention channels.
Very cool. Random question for both of you is like, with an agency that does email, since most people have this in-house and some people are hiring agents, but what is the heaviest hire? Is it the writers of those or the strategists or what? I'm super keen from the owners of businesses who only focus on this, like where the biggest budget and energy is needed.
Yeah, good question. So I think your dream hire is an end-to-end marketer who kind of knows how to tinker. Because when I was at Best Self, I could like launch it in Klaviyo and like write all the copy and like whip together something in Canva. And that's going to be like the most, like, it's never going to be 100%, but I think that's like the best and most expensive hire to like start with. But if you're like a little bit bigger, like more of like a 20-ish million dollar business, 30 million, and you're like actually looking to build out an email marketing team, I think your strategist, your email marketing manager, your strategist is probably the most expensive hire. And then from there, either like the copywriter or designer, depending on like which way your brand leans, but probably the designer probably before copywriter in terms of like sheer expense. But that strategist is for sure going to be your most expensive hire. And it is for us as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm much smaller than Jess. I mean, we're only like six people, but the something I'm actually experimenting with right now is combining the copywriter and strategist in one position.
Ooh.
Because my hypothesis is that there's a lot of synergies to be had. Because when I mean, obviously Jess and I started doing all of these ourselves, and I always look at it like, well, the copywriter has to work themselves into the brand material so deeply, and the strategist kind of has too. So I was like, well, if just one person does that step and then also can churn out copy, that'd be really cool. So that's something I'm experimenting with right now. Don't take this as advice. I'll tell you if it burns everything down or not.
Let me know how that goes, because I feel like it's been a 2-year process of like dividing me into 10 different pieces. Like, you start off doing the freelance thing, or you're doing every part of the position, and then it's like, cool, this is totally one hire, and then six mishires later, you're like, okay, cool, this is probably two positions or three positions.
Yep.
So,
I think that's a good answer to that, because it's a like, you can tell you guys are actually marketers, not just like agency owners trying to turn clients out, because your way you're approaching it is how you approach marketing, with like a theory that you try out and do, versus, oh, well, your overhead and churn rate of humans who can sell billable hours is this, which I think is very refreshing. So that's cool.
So is email marketing still viable? Still alive in 2021?
But is email dead yet? Question.
Yeah.
I think it's still working. I mean, it's still definitely viable. Still usually we're seeing like, you know, 30-ish percent of revenue is coming from email pretty consistently on the e-com side. But I think the landscape has for sure changed. Like, I've noticed that people's attention span is a lot shorter. Like, even little things, like, I think when I did the presentation in Croatia, we would still have these like long, like, welcome flow nurture things, like long post-purchase nurtures, like, let's tell this brand story. And now like everything is condensed. Like, we got to convert them within the first 3 emails in 3 days, or we just lose them. And then every email after that is like completely dead. So little changes like that I'm just noticing in like consumer behavior. And I think just also with COVID, like more brands coming onto e-com, it's kind of changed like the attention span and competitiveness in the inbox.
For sure. I can second that.
And do you think in that conversation of attention span and all that, that the business drives some of that? Like, if you're a very niche business where you're wanting to read those emails versus more broad strokes, mass market, like e-com brand, that you're noticing with different clients or different projects, that it's not like a catch-all rule. Some people have very specific businesses where they want more content from their brand to customer ratio versus like selling a beverage.
Melanie, do you want to touch on this?
Yeah, sure. I think it really depends on your brand. And for me, that question ties into this notion I feel like a lot of marketers have where they're like, just send an email to be in touch and be in communication. And I feel like a lot of people overlook how strong of an email channel you can build if you just change your lens and you change it to the perspective of, is this email adding value to the person's inbox that I'm sending it to? So, you know, if the question's about like long form content and attention span, I have some clients, they send out like this super weird newsletter. It's so long. And like, when I read it, I'm like, God, this is so boring. But it's their best performing email out of all the emails. Their standard e-com brand, this newsletter is their best performing thing. It's super long form content. They send it out like bi-weekly. So I think it depends on your brand and it depends on, you know, what's the value add. I've seen a lot of emails that are even, you know, longer perform really well. If one, the audience is primed for that, they're expecting that. And two, it's actually super valuable what you're sending to them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I second that. I think it's also about mixing it up. So it's like, hey, long form content works generally for different brands, but not just long form content. And like one thing we've noticed with, like we work with a bunch of like lifestyle businesses now. So like baby sunglasses, like bracelets, apparel, like that kind of stuff as well. So, you know, likely not going to write an essay on a hoodie. But we found that like founder letters work really well for those types of brands when we sprinkle it in here or there. And it's like a longer form, like, hey, here's what I've been up to. Or like, here's the mission of the business. Like, here's what we're working on. And like that kind of type of long form content in that context does really well. Whereas like if we just try to force long form content for the sake of testing long form versus short form, like it just always loses for those types of brands. So I think it's finding that context where like fitting the medium to message kind of approach.
Makes perfect sense. And it's the same thing. Nothing's ever the same for all things and you have to mix it up. You can't just follow a formula and hope it works out doing the same thing every day.
Software. Is it still Klaviyo or are there other people coming on the horizon? For e-commerce?
No Klaviyo. Still Klaviyo on my end.
Same here. Melanie, I think, yeah. They're a beast. I mean, I think Klaviyo is going to, or Klaviyo, however you want to say it, I think they're going to become even more relevant if they stop sleeping on what a massive data analysis reporting tool they actually have hidden within their platform.
Reporting is not as good as it should be. I totally agree with you.
But you guys would love to be seeing some aggregate reports from that. You'd probably even pay for like a newsletter from them of trends and things that are coming from
them.
They
just started that.
Okay.
They're doing like these industry benchmarks now they sent out where you can like go in and you can compare your performance to industry stuff. Pretty cool.
They're pretty much good. And I actually want them to be able to like have a better almost like BI platform of like slicing data. Like I want to know like cohort data of like people who convert off of this email, like how does it convert further on and like test results. Like I want them to do more of like a, what's that called? VBO. It's a VBO, the split testing software. Something like website split testing software. Yeah. Like have that platform on email. I don't know why it's so hard to split test on email. It's like so manual of a process.
Yeah.
Great. Question for folks who might be a little newer to this game and have it, and just took whatever software the kid they hired to put their site stuck with like MailChimp or whatever the hell. Like, why is it such a beast that's going to stay?
I can just go. So Melanie, do you want to start?
I mean, you go, I'll add to it if I have anything.
So I think it's what we just touched on, like data is a sheer like driver behind all of that. Cause at the end of the day, what powers your email strategy and what makes email such a special channel is that you can speak to customers as segmented as you would like compared to like a Facebook ads, Google ads, you know, that kind of thing. So the whole point of email is that I can personalize the contents of an email based on what they bought, what they viewed, how they've engaged on our site, like how they filled out surveys. I can target like how email, like which emails send to those segments as well. So like all of that personalization, I think, is like the core of what makes email such a special channel. And what powers all that personalization is that data. And that means like we need a clean way way to organize that data. We need to be able to collect it. And then we also need to be able to like splice it how we want. And like Klaviyo's conditional logic setup is like by far the best I've seen, where it's like you can really splice people however you want to. And they're also just collecting so much data and like you can customize it. So like we've been doing, we've just been like doing really cool shit around like having a single email show up like 10 different ways depending on what products they bought in the past. And like that kind of stuff, that kind of strategy is what makes email great. And like you just can't execute it on any other platform when you have MailChimp that like you can barely segment by like engagement, you know?
Yep. And they're building, you know, I think just the one thing I have to add to that is they're building some incredibly cool like AI stuff, like predictive analytics about people where based on their data, their AI basically just says, oh, this person's likely to buy in the next 14 days. And I think that's just going to become more and more and more where they tell you like predictive gender and they just use all this massive data they have to kind of like give you even more information than you've actually collected. And that's both scary and for us, obviously very exciting.
Right. I think the, we were actually talking about this before this, the consumer version of what we like and the marketer version of what we like and why, which is very different.
Funnel. So let's move to like strategy. So a lot of people want to know about funnels, email funnels, I imagine. So before we ask about best practices, like when people say email funnels, what the hell are they talking about?
I don't actually know. I feel like it can mean a bunch of different things. How do you interpret it, Melanie?
I think when someone says email funnel to me, I think usually what they mean is like the welcome flow, the abandoned cart flow.
Right.
Because like, the Klaviyo, they're now flows, not funnels. Funnel is such a weird fucking word.
Well, funnel's like authentic. It's abused and tacked on to a million things to work because some marketers were good at selling people that if you didn't have a funnel, it didn't work.
Right.
Yeah. I think they mean flows.
Yeah, so in your world, the flow, right, which I can see now, you would probably draw out the flow of step one. This is what happens if yes, if no, and you know they have that. Do you guys have any just best practices, high level stuff that you've learned over time? It's just you do this, you don't do this. Just some rules people can go by as they might not be as pro as you guys at this.
Yeah, have them. That's a really good place to start usually. Have flows. And I think a big differentiator that I always notice is a lot of people, they do like, you know, like this is like people who just start out and they're just putting their emails in and they'll have like a one email flow, like a one email welcome or stuff like that. And I see total differences in like really having like, you know, multiple email flows. I even go up to sometimes like have 7 email flows if it matches the brand, if it matches the content, if we see it performs well. We'll go crazy like that.
Yeah. So I figured this is a cool conversation. So you've got over 100,000 customers. You've only tried to sell them your own stuff and you're not really brand communicated as email marketing geniuses. Like what would you see? Cause this is not an uncommon thing because people focus on the areas they're good at, which is different sometimes than email, and email is just the thing you do. You see that, what kind of ideas do you start popping up with?
Yeah. So I kind of approach flows going back to just like the classic marketing funnel. So you kind of have like your awareness, your customer, and your retention section. So awareness is like anyone who's on your list who hasn't purchased, customers, people in that like purchase intent journey kind of phase. And then retention is like ongoing, extending their LTV. So I always say like, if you don't have any flow set up, that's the top five I always approach with is welcome flow, browse abandonment, add to cart, abandoned cart, post-purchase nurture. Start there, and that's going to be like your highest ROI, like top 5 flows. And then from there, I would add on like maybe like a cross-sell or replenishment, depending on your type of product, and then like a win-back. If you have like those, what is that, 7? Those 7 flows core set up, like I think that's like the 80-20 in terms of like effort to ROI that I would work on. And then the second thing in terms of best practices is like I really pivoted to more of an iterative approach. So we used to build out these like long 10, 15 email sequences right off the bat. And like if they work, they were great, but they're just like high risk in terms of like how many resources you put into it. Whereas now like we'll do like a 3 email welcome flow first and launch those 3 and then build out the other 2 emails or add on to the flow instead. Because what we're really noticing is like the drop off on revenue inflows is like getting earlier and earlier. So it used to be the top three emails in a welcome flow generated 80% of the revenue. Now it's like the top one email in a welcome flow generates 80% of the revenue. So I think, yeah, I think like in terms of like best practices and where to start, if you have no email marketing set up, but you have like a good like set up like good substantial businesses, like get those top 5 to 7 flows launched, have each one have like 2 to 3 emails to start, and then continue adding to what's already working.
On that flow question, the mix of selling the product that I came there for versus teaching me about other things to build my brand and my knowledge and your like value to your customer versus maybe selling affiliate products and stuff like that. I'd be keen to know, because I think so many people are focused on selling their thing versus building a relationship and possibly selling other products that they don't have to make and making money. Just really keen to know y'all's aspect from living in it.
I love this question because we've actually like changed our mind on this as well. So we used to do like whole emails would be selling a product, and then we'd be nurturing, and then we'd be like selling the product. So it might be like, for example, Welcome Flow would be like, hey, here's our product catalog, and like, here's our brand story and our mission. And then like, hey, here's some products you would like. And those would be like 3 separate emails. And again, going back to the whole, you know, customer's attention span and that drop off is steeper and steeper now. We try to meld the content and the product selling into one email. So it's like, hey, every email mentions a little bit about their brand story, or like maybe links to a blog post or has some sort of value give. But also every email is still highlighting a product or highlighting a product catalog or like pushing a testimonial or something. So we've kind of pivoted pretty heavily in the last, you know, 6 to 8 months towards meshing the two in single emails instead of like having a dedicated storytelling email or nurture email, and then also a dedicated like product email. So I think it goes back to like the whole, you know, make every email valuable, like Melanie mentioned, like every email should kind of tell the story. Every email should kind of sell the product, because you're kind of trying to do all of that at once.
Are you finding that the emails only sell your product, or are you actually building enough brand to sell other people's products?
We don't do any of the affiliate stuff.
It's so tricky with e-com brands. That's really tricky to do, actually,
Can you explain why?
I want to hear the logic.
I feel like I've gone back and forth on a bunch of baby bathwater forums and panels on this. So Melanie, do you want to tackle it first?
Sorry, good question then. Because as affiliate marketers, I see Dreamlist, right? And then as e-com email marketers, you're like, it's tough. And I'd love to put myself in your shoes of thinking.
So Melanie first on this one.
Yeah.
Totally. I think a lot of people, when they start email, they use it to build their brand. So the goal is like, email is a thing we're going to build our brand with. We're going to create our relationship with the customer with. And so when you start mixing in other products and you're starting to sell other products, I think a lot of founders feel like that takes away from their messaging and their brand. And then suddenly you also become responsible for a whole different funnel, right? If I'm selling you pillows, but I recommended this like blanket to you that someone else sells, and you go and you purchase that blanket and you go through that whole funnel, and that's a negative experience, ultimately I'm responsible for that. So there's a whole different funnel that I'm not directly managing, but essentially is responsible for how you perceive my brand. And then again, you know, like I think the revenue someone can make from affiliate compared to the revenue you can make from actually getting them to come back and purchase your products and your product variations, you know, I'm not big in the affiliate marketing, but I would almost assume that it's probably worth it more to convert the customer for my brand in that space, that valuable email space that I have, than to convert it for someone else's brand.
Jess?
I'd echo the same things. We have a handful of clients that are kind of like in that middle line of like, we do a few affiliate links here and there. And I think it really goes back to more of the difference in industry and the types of customers you're attracting. So like those brands are a little bit more in that gray area. The affiliate stuff does kind of work, but it's never a huge push. Whereas the brands that are like really branded, like really focused on their own products, like we don't even touch the affiliate stuff there, because the times that we've even tried like gift guides or like highlighting other products, the clicks are crazy low. Like just customers are not interested in looking at any other products. I think the the companies and brands themselves feel like it ruins their brand perception, and the audiences that they're attracting just aren't as interested in hearing from other products, because that's kind of not what they showed up for. So I think it's the whole like matching the medium to the message kind of thing. Like, you know, Levitt, you and I have talked about like using images and like design stuff and affiliates. And it's like, for some reason, like those types of email designs just like don't work for that audience. Like for some reason, affiliate links just like really don't stick with the e-com industry. And I don't know if I have a really good answer to why, but I think it's really just the type of audience and like who they're attracting and like what they're used to.
Right.
I think a little bit, it feels like catfishing too. I think for someone to be like, because we've done these emails before too, where we like have a really close partner and we're like, okay, we're going to do one email and we're going to just like introduce this product by our partner. And there's like that moment of your customer going, hold on, this is, I didn't subscribe to get this type of product. I subscribed to understand about that product and get informed about that brand and that product. And so there's a little bit of an alienation where they kind of feel like this feels like now I'm getting advertisement versus now I'm getting your brand communication.
Right. Yeah,
this brings up a memory I totally forgot existed. But I remember one time at Best Self, there was one Black Friday where we had like our usual promotions. We also did like partnership bundles. So it was still a Best Self product, but like partnered with another brand that we felt like was relevant. Those bundles just like really did not work. It was like comical, the number of sales that came in through Black Friday and how little of it was through those bundles. And I think that was like a great example of like our product was already in that thing already. Even introducing a brand in that way, it still didn't stick for that audience for some reason.
Good info.
I think this is good. I honestly like disagree with a lot of it from having a different email list, but I don't think that the debate is centered if it's an e-com brand or if it's a this or a that. It's more like the overarching thing you've talked about the whole time, which is the matching the message and why the person came to you. Because like Michael and I see these emails go out where we do set up affiliate campaigns, but we work just on making sure the message matches the audience and it's for the reason they came. If it was, you know, to be healthier, whatever it is, it's something that aligns and that the funnel does check out. Obviously, they have to do that work, but then they don't have to make the counter argument is they don't have to make the product, service the product, or do it. And sometimes they're getting just as much commission as the brand if you can make a good messaging and marketing to it. So this sounds like a cool topic to dive into as a whole side item.
There's some people who just sell a cheap thing in a space just so they could be an affiliate.
I'm open to the idea that affiliate stuff could work in e-com and just no one has done it right yet.
I think it's a really cool conversation that we should rehash in here, which is I'm glad we brought it up because I think this can spur up some internal debates. Because, you know, you got the cynic and gears, like send an email every day and like everything makes money. And then you have the e-commerce brands that are just letting you know when there's discounts and sales and they're brand focused. But there's some really cool e-com brands and they introduced me a product that has more weight because they did it because it was done right. It's a fun conversation that has no steadfast.
We disagree with you guys. We're just going to take over now. let's get away from that. Email capture, like any good recommendations on capturing people's email addresses?
I have a super weird A/B test that whenever I run it, for some reason, I get the same result. And I'm curious to hear if Jess has the same.
I didn't hear this.
The same experience. So whenever I run, and we obviously my recommendation is run A/B tests on your email captures. So A/B tests on design, A/B tests on type, A/B tests on your offer. So like the standard, like 10% off, $10 off, giveaway, or just like even just value. And then design stuff, of course, too. Best practice, just don't run a pop-up on mobile because Google's SEO will kill you. So back to the original thing. Every time I run this A/B test, it's like having a super nice designed, high quality pop-up versus a super plain, just plain color pop-up. The plain color pop-up, 10 out of 10 so far, has always won. And I'm curious if Jess has the same experience.
So question for you before that, how do your clients feel about that?
You know, it's always an interesting conversation. It depends on the brand. So sometimes I'll have really high branded brands and they're like, you know what, it actually is okay. It's such a Like the difference is not that important to us as is the brand perception of how our brand looks. And Jess, I know you work with a lot of apparel brands. Interestingly, a lot of apparel brands feel like that. And then I have some brands.
Losing tests over the winning tests for aesthetics reasons, right?
Yeah. They're like, no, we'll keep the worst performing one because it matches our brand style more.
So I feel like this is the perfect encapsulation of the e-com industry that is, which is related to why we don't do affiliate stuff. And like, it's this protection of the brand.
That I actually just whispered to Michael. That's the reason, because it's an ego pride thing around the brand. So like when I view, we're back to it again, but when I view the, like, why would I not sell their products? It's like, some people have one SKU and they spend all this money and energy building it. Like, I don't want to hear, I like that brand, I like what they stand for, but I want to hear from it. But that founder who that SKU that they built is their Taj Mahal that they're emotionally invested in. So as agency runners, you're like, here's what works, but man, the guy who views this as his, you know, beautiful grandkid that is his, and I tell him the ugly thing works, and I'm putting an ugly thing on your pretty thing because it works, they're going to be distraught with that.
Yeah. So I just wanted to call out that particular element of the e-com industry in particular, which is like you choose a losing test sometimes just for like brand aesthetic reasons.
The founder might be right sometimes. It brings up a more philosophical thing, or not philosophical, like whether it's right. Like sometimes building brand for the long term is more important than short term revenue. So they're not necessarily making a wrong decision.
It's complex like life, right? Where it could be because if our retail buyers see this, they're going to be like, well, what kind of hangers and packaging are they going to send us if they would put this on their website? That kills a channel. Or we don't monetize our email list anyway, so why would we make something ugly on our, you know, I think this is a cool can of worms of the philosophical difference of who makes the decision around it and what their motivations are around it.
And brand versus performance, just like nature versus nurture. There's no answer. It's a balance, right? Nobody knows.
Yeah, and I think there is this underlying root of like affiliate marketing will kill e-com brands. Like that is the fundamental belief in the industry. Whether or not that's grounded is a totally different discussion. But I think that's like the answer why of like why we don't do affiliate stuff. I don't think it's for a particularly like good data-driven reason necessarily.
It could have done wrong for sure. Cool. So email capture. So you say
to affiliates.
No, any other email capture recommendations besides like the ugly plain ones beating the pretty? Any cool unique way to capture
emails? Honestly, we haven't even touched the ugly plain one, Melanie. So I'm curious if I can even get that test approved with our clients. I don't think that would fly. But that's also super cool. We do pretty standard stuff. So we'll do, I mean, the usual like 10%, 10 like. Percent off, dollar off, free gift. Mystery offer has worked really well for us, whether it's framed as like mystery offer or like special gift or like however you want to phrase it, but it's basically like you hide the actual offer behind the pop-up. That's worked for a few clients pretty well. We've been testing people shots versus product shots on the pop-up itself. And we're finding people shots tend to edge out product shots ever so slightly. Sure. It's not definitive enough to be like a slam dunk, but I think it's a test that's worthwhile running.
On the mystery prize comment, is there a motivating factor that has just beat out other motivating factors from discounts to mystery to the spin the wheel to get a free thingy? I'm curious of y'all's knowledge of that.
What do you mean by motivating factor?
That was my question too.
What is the thing you're giving me to give me your email? Like, is it, I want to be on your newsletter. I want 10% off. I want a mystery gift. I want to spin the little Shopify wheel in the corner and see if I win.
So that freaking wheel wins all the time. And we usually end up taking it off because of brand aesthetic reasons. But that spin wheel just crushes it. Anything you run off, always lose next to the spin wheel. So that's been pretty much.
Do you guys end up catering a lot of your stuff to what's going to get approved for maybe some broader reasons than the mission you have at hand a lot? It sounds like.
I think that, so, I mean, honestly, even if I was on the other side, on the brand side, I would probably still make the same call that our clients do.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're giving to clients. I think it's really just prioritizing the brand over necessarily every single data point.
Multiple metrics.
But what if it's a luxury spin wheel? I mean, I guess what Hal's trying to ask the motivation is like there's reward or surprise, right? So the spin wheel, like when you're trying to take something that might be kludgy, like when I used to go to dark net things, but I had a real brand, I would like, okay, that thing's working, right? But what is it, what is really working, right? And then how do you take that, the deep human thingy, and how do you replicate the spin wheel?
So the motivating factor question is more what psychological trigger, because you can dress things up and make that wheel could be cool. It could be painted sticks for the millennial brand instead of the, go ahead.
Give me the idea.
Quizzes, in my opinion, are like the luxury version of spin the wheel stuff. So there's an amazing beauty brand. They have this killer quiz where they basically make you go through it to find out your perfect shade, and you can get like a free sample of that shade. You just pay shipping. That's a huge, great top of funnel capture for emails that has that same, I think it's like this gamification aspect, you know, like that spin the wheel. You just want to know which one are you going to get, you know? Or with the mystery product, I think the reason it performs so well, it's just like, you just want to know, you just need to know what is it that you're going to get. And with those quizzes, the ones I see performing really well, it's always like, you kind of want to know what's my result going to be, right? Like, you just want to know what's my shade of
curiosity and the game. That's when Jess said mystery. And then you said quiz. Now my gut's like, that is the motivating psychological piece. That's
If I was going to go deeper on the quiz wheel, I think we're missing it. It's that you just might win big, even though they might look at the dots and nothing's big. You see a wheel, and unconsciously from slot machines or whatever, you think you just might get a fucking new car, even though you know. I think you don't think about it like that. So I'm wondering if you can replicate the wheel, but that's what's going down.
Well, it's funny. I just took an awesome quiz funnel that I've shared with a bunch of people that was from men. I don't ever buy men's cleaning products. Like, I just get whatever, Cynthia got from the store. But then it was a shampoo that was like, what kind of hair do you have? And it was a very male, easy, mobile funnel. And now I'm on a subscription for a super expensive soap and shampoo because it took me like 10 minutes to do. And so it made me feel that also I was just waiting for you to be like, you have great, awesome hair. You don't need shampoo or something. Like, I think psychologically I've been trying to figure out why it works so well, because it was pretty time committing.
Yeah, but I think this is a really good point as well in terms of like the quality of the quiz actually needs to make sense for your product. So I've seen a lot of brands try to like, oh, quizzes work. Let me just slap a quiz. And it's like, if it's like a jewelry line, it's like, which charm is yours? It's like, customers see through that. Like, those quizzes just don't work. Whereas like right now we have one client that has like, it mixes and matches dog supplements based on your dog profile. So the quiz is like, you fill in your dog age and breed and like their allergies and like all that kind of stuff. So like that quiz actually makes sense for like the end result that you're going to get. It's also great for like collecting customer info, even if they don't close.
I think another motivating factor is behind this is like, people just want to talk about themselves. That's all they want to do. They just want to know, what kind of hair do I have? What kind of skin tone do I have? I mean, I can look in the freaking mirror. I can see what kind of skin tone I have, but they just want to talk about themselves. And I think that's why quizzes also work really well.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember sitting with Lovitch as he worked on one of the very first quiz funnels ever. What body shape size you were.
I had the first weight loss quiz funnel ever. Self supplement.
And then just, it'll move on to the next thing and not tie it back to affiliate, but I would challenge the same reason affiliate would work would be if you were to take the same logic of making sure the quiz matched the product, that the content matched the reason why they aligned with your brand.
Or get one of those people to give away like a really expensive thing on the roulette wheel.
Mm-hmm. There's so many fun ways. Yeah. We're going to start a whole new agency.
Just getting leads. All right. Create a segment. So segmentation, you alluded to it earlier, but are any like good creative, like new ways of segmenting you've been doing that has been moving the needle? Or ways of looking at segmentation?
Go ahead, Melanie.
Well, I was just going to say there's really two ways I look at segmentation, which is one, behavior. Like, what have these people been doing on my website? What have they been looking at? When were they last here? What are they clicking? How are they engaging with my emails? And then there's like the, just like the customer profile segmentation, like where are they located? What's their gender? If I know it.
What do you find more powerful, the behavioral or the psychographic?
That's a tricky question. I think what's more powerful for email, for me right now at least, is behavioral, simply because we we normally, unless there's like an elaborate quiz or whatnot, don't have that much customer profile information, right? Or unless we kind of get them to come back and give us that information. Just from a conversion standpoint, I think behavioral tells me a lot about how close they are to actually making a purchase. So that's why I would give it a little bit of an edge over.
How about you, Jess? Behavioral versus psychographic.
That's interesting. So we very rarely use psychographic information unless it's like very, unless it gets too, super obvious. So for example, at that dog supplement brand I mentioned, like, you know, if people are filling out a survey that they need immunity, we're going to send them immunity content. But I always lean towards the side of like the whole, you know, customers don't know what they want until you show them what they want, and I trust what they do more than what they say. So it's like, even if someone's like, hey, you know, I'm shopping for the XYZ, I'm like, you don't know what you want. I want to see what you want. So I want to see what pages you're viewing on this website. Like, I don't really care what you're telling me on the survey. So we pretty much, like, I'd say like 80 to 90% of our targeting is behavioral. And then we use a 10% for like super obvious ones. If it's like, it's cold, it's a cold product. I'm like, you know, target Canada when it's cold, like sunglasses, target hot states, like that kind of stuff. But I always train my team to kind of split the behavioral into three different buckets. So one is engagement on emails, like open the clicks. Mm-hmm. Second one is purchase behavior. And then third one is website behavior. So actually split purchase and website behavior into two different things.
Oh, cool.
So we can sorry, go ahead.
Makes such sense. I mean, according to science, behavioral, nobody knows who they are or anything. So all that's junk. According to any neuroscience you read, it's all junk information anyway. So behavior.
Yeah, so even when we layer in psychographic, I use it more like the cherry on top. So it's like, I'm still going to use behavioral, and then we'll force, like, it's like if we're doing an immunity thing, we'll still use behavioral as like 80% of the targeting, but we'll also for sure layer in anyone who said they're interested in immunity. So I really see it as more of like a, just, you know, let's throw them in there, but I'm not gonna make all my decisions based on this result.
On that testing kind of topic, what about subject lines and from names? Like, without going down the rabbit hole too much, just knowing any cool maybe experiments or things you've learned, things like that. I remember changing the from name and for the first time ever and going, oh my God, look what happened. But like, you know, it's kind of interesting to hear from y'all's opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you go, Jess. You go first this time.
We never play around with from names very much unless it's a founder email. Again, brand perception. So we don't really do with that on the e-com side. In terms of subject lines, it's been super interesting lately. I think it's really been showing me how different audiences react totally differently, and we don't have any sort of like, this subject line type works best all the time. We had two clients recently when we were testing during Black Friday, and like when you actually have the sale in the subject line, it works less effectively. And I'm like, what? This is like literally against every marketing best practice, but it was a pretty clear winner after like 30 cents that having the actual like 50% off, like after, like it worked in the beginning of the sale because I think it was still new and flashy, but when you're like 20 emails into this thing, like people, it actually works better if we highlight different parts of the product and the benefits and the brand and like that kind of thing. And then we've noticed like for brands that targeted parents a little bit more, they want it to the point, benefit oriented and short. Like none of that like, oh my God, you can't believe that. And they're like, their moms are tired. They just want you to tell them what they're gonna get. And then they'll open the email. It's like very direct. So we've really been honing in more on like the demographic, the audience. Like parents are a very specific type of like demographic to be speaking to. Whereas like if we're talking, we have one brand that's like Instagram influencers are targeting like 14 to like 25 year olds. Like that's going to be a whole, like you kind of want the clickbaity attention stuff. And then some that are like more 35 to 55 year old guys, like that's a whole different demographic. So we've really been noticing the difference in subject line performance based on demos and less around like best practices.
Yeah, I can only second that. My favorite test to always run is emoji, no emoji. Sometimes it's a super clear winner. Sometimes it's a super big bomb. So for some reason, I just personally like that test. Maybe I just like emojis, but that's a big one. From name is really interesting. I also like running that. And I think that one's interesting because sometimes it's tricky, you know, if you have like the brand name and you're like, okay, let's switch it around and let's do like Melanie from brand name. You have to test that one a little bit longer because sometimes what happens is people are so used to actually receiving, you know, you've trained your customer to already receive just your brand name, that when you switch something, it just takes a little bit of time for people to get used to it. That's something I've noticed too, where it's like really interesting when you switch something that's been like established and your customers are so trained to expect that, there's a little bit of a learning curve for you to actually see like, oh, what does actually perform better?
But that's the overarching thing. Like, interesting. Do you want them to be trained that this is how I do it? Or do you want to keep surprises so you can get more action from time to time by mixing it up, which I think is that's an overarching test, right, of how you would do it.
That's a whole new philosophical question.
Yeah. I have so much shit going on in my brain because of this.
I want to list a test with right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to the real stuff again. What are, you alluded to it a little earlier, but what are some, Jess, you listed them out earlier, but what are some automations you just can't ignore? Like, if you don't have these automations, just quit your job now and email.
Welcome flow, browse abandonment, add to cart, abandoned cart. The add to cart is a newer one just in terms of like how Shopify gets set up. So add to cart is when someone adds it to cart, but abandoned cart only kicks in when someone actually clicks like start checkout and like enters their billing information. So those are the top four flows from like a top of funnel conversion kind of standpoint. I always start with the post-purchase nurture because it's like, hey, let's set us up for success for retention by like not just ghosting the customer after they bought. So I usually do like at least one or two post-purchase nurtures. So those would be my top five. And then the two like bonus ones, if you're like an A player, is a cross sell slash replenishment, depending on what kind of product you have, and then a win back. So those are the top seven flows to work on.
Yeah. And coming from like, so I work with a lot of like replenishable goods where people, food and bev, you know, they eat it and then it's going to be gone and they're going to have to order more. So I'm a really big believer in like really extensive. That's where I think I'm a little bit different than like other email marketers. I'm a big believer in the post-purchase flow. I think most brands, they focus really heavily on like welcome and abandoned cart, and they try everything they can to convert their customer, and then their customer converts and then the entire experience goes to shit because they get this shitty order confirmation from Shopify and no one thinks about, okay, now that we've converted them, what do we do to like excite them and turn them into an advocate? And really like get them to refer people to us, get them to give us an awesome testimonial, get them to come back and purchase more. So I've been experimenting a lot with really breaking down the post-purchase flow by like number of purchases. So someone who's purchased once gets a totally different experience now who, when they purchase the second time and then the third time and then, you know, four plus, we kind of like, at one point you kind of got to stop. But a really, really big one too is, a lot of people have subscriptions now. So a lot of people use Recharge to just have subscriptions, making a specific subscriber flow. I think that's super overlooked too. Where, you know, if someone comes and subscribes, granted you have that automated revenue, but how do you keep that? That's a super high customer lifetime value subscriber, just creating a flow specifically for them where they know, you know, they're like, they're your VIP customer and there's more value added to the subscription than just getting the product maybe at a discount and automatically. And obviously that then ties into like specific subscriber campaigns, but that's like my big thing is like go ham on the post-purchase flow. I think there's a lot to be like created there.
Yeah, 100%. I want to echo that too. Like we're literally building out like a 21 email post-purchase for like one particular customer segment for one of our clients right now. It's a whole beast of a thing. And I think it's like, that's wouldn't be where I would start. And I think I don't think that's what Melanie was saying either. But like when you're ready to like go seriously deep in email marketing, your like foundations are set, like post-purchase nurture is going to be like that first flow to just really build out.
So they showed you they'll put with their dollars and now that's a much more quality lead. You're going to do something with it. And if people are listening to this who are playing on the fringes of it, I think a big factor is, like Melanie said, a replenishable good versus if you have one SKU or you have multiple SKUs, that post-purchase flow is going to be dictated by what your business is allowing you to accomplish as well.
Maybe that would be a good time for affiliate stuff.
Just screaming for it. Yeah.
All right, let's go to break it up. So SMS. Now everybody's doing both. So explain how that, before we even say SMS, SMS is text, but explain that little dance going on there.
I have a very unique position on SMS. So Maybe so, I'll give my unique position on SMS and then Jess can give you some more like actual hands-on stuff.
Honestly, we probably start the same way because I've resisted us launching SMS for like literally a year. So,
I mean, I love SMS. I just think a lot of businesses are doing it really badly. It's such a personal channel, you know, like who do I want to have access to my phone and what kind of stuff do I want to receive on my phone? And if you want to see really bad SMS marketing, go subscribe to Eaze, E-A-Z-E. They're Canos Delivery. I've never unsubscribed so quickly from something.
Yeah, I've been watching it as a marketer, not as a user. It's crazy.
I've unsubscribed so quick. And if you want really good SMS marketing, I have this little tiny brand. I am absolutely in love with. They're called We're Not Really Strangers. And the reason I think they do SMS marketing really well is I think people are so accustomed to receiving marketing emails with promotions now, and that's okay. So you can run that there much easier than you could on SMS. But on SMS, I think there's still, it's a personal channel and people want to receive something that's not a promotion. You don't want to have your phone ding and look at it and see a promotion. That's just like even more stressful. And We're Not Really Strangers. They're basically a card game that's like all about asking each other like really deep questions and opening up and getting really vulnerable. And so they send the funniest or funnest text messages. And I literally just got one and stuff like, tell someone how much they mean to you today. People need more love than they show. And yesterday they texted, everyone's love looks different. And the day before they texted, I'm proud of the progress you're making, no matter how small. I love these texts. I've probably screenshotted and posted them on Instagram so many times. I've recommended to subscribe to so many friends. And every once in a while, they'll send the promotional text and be like, hey, by the way, our card game is 50% off. And you best believe I have no issues receiving those promotional texts because in between, I get so much good, juicy stuff that it's probably one of my favorite things to be subscribed to.
I like Cards Against Humanity would have a really fun time with that. Yeah. You're with your friends and you get a prompt question. That's good. But if, you know, the company that sells me socks probably only has so many ideas they could come up with to do funny things to keep me engaging, but they could.
I mean, you can get creative, right? Like I work with a company, they sell like sleep aid stuff. And we were just talking about strategy. I'm like, hey, there's really cool stuff you can send at like 8:30. Just be like, hey, you know, in 30 minutes, it might be time for your bed routine, just sending you a gentle reminder. Or at like 8 p.m., be like, hey, don't forget to floss tonight. You know, right. I mean, it's really about how creative you get with it.
Yeah, I just hate socks. That was the only reason I
Okay.
So what's your opinion on the SMS?
Oh, I feel the same way. I just feel like most brands do it so terribly that I was like, I don't want to be that sleazy marketer. We can't ever go into SMS. So, but obviously I've caved now. We're doing SMS.
So what's working now? The sleazy stuff? Is that what's working?
No, we're actually just in beta. So we have a few clients signed up and we're like launching in the next 2 weeks or so. But I think with SMS, so it's like very early on. So I don't have anything like definitive of the, hey, this is working or not working. But I think with SMS, even more so than email, it's like you really have to start with like the value-driven side of things first, but and don't even try to push for the sale too aggressively because I think that's where people get really sensitive to it. So a couple of ideas we're like kind of starting to test is like, hey, we have like one dog brand that's like, hey, what would it look like if we had a character that was like a dog that was kind of speaking to you and it was just like a fun, like quirky text you get every day, or like doing a little bit more geo-targeting of like, hey, you're in Austin, like these are the best dog parks in Austin, and doing it like that instead of just pushing the sale constantly. And like, obviously we'll still have like an abandoned cart SMS and things like that. But really looking for that, like a playful sheer value add, like joy in your day kind of thing.
So what's the dance between the two? So you have email and SMS, right? You're not gonna get rid of email for SMS. So how are they coordinated?
I like this question. So we're really playing around on the flow side. So it's a lot of like we instead of having an SMS flow and an email flow, it's one flow that incorporates both email and SMS. So if, for example, an abandoned cart flow might be if they don't open the email in 24 hours, then send them the SMS. Or we're also trying to choose what we want to say. So for example, with this dog brand, they have a feature where you can like text your vet or like and ask them a question. So that, to me, like that's a very natural thing to be communicating on text instead of email, because it's a very direct response kind of experience. So for us, it's really just like, hey, we have these two channels at our disposal. Like, what are we trying to say throughout this customer experience and this flow? Which channel best serves that? And also, let's make sure they're not speaking over each other. So it's either like, if they don't open the SMS, then they get the email, or they open the email, then they don't get the SMS, that kind of dance. Which is also another answer to the why Klaviyo is amazing question. Because you can actually...
I was actually just about to ask, what is the tool you guys are using to send these and track these and do it? Is that
it can do both channels. It's integrated into one platform, so, and you can segment the same way as well. Whereas I think when we have some clients that are unattentive for email and then Klaviyo for SMS, and like there's just a lot of overlap because you just can't segment the same way.
I'm not a super big fan of Attentive simply because I've just run into like a bunch of clients who've had super big integration issues with Attentive for whatever reason. I do like Postscript for SMS as well. They're also good.
Postscript.
Yeah.
Have you guys messed around with Community?
I've heard of Community. I think a lot of celebrities use that, right?
I think it's really cool. Because it does make it feel more personal, and you can send files and stuff like you would to a friend, but it's definitely more of a personal thing. And I think it would be a tough pitch to fragile brands because it's different, but it's a fun thing to mess around with. But I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I got to check that out.
Okay, so for a lot of people just starting off, like with a small list, like when can you start testing experiments? Like how big does your list need to be to actually start testing shit?
We're into member questions now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a statistical significance question, yeah, right? Like at what point is it statistically significant?
Yeah.
But I would say never shy away from testing. Like if I personally, it's like it's never too soon to start testing. I mean, maybe if you have 5 people on your list, that's all, you know, not that much, but statistical significance is like a math question, right? Like, yes, even if you have 50 people on your list, if your test is so overweighingly leaning into one direction, that's probably a good hint, maybe even if it's not statistically significant. So,
yeah, I mean, when I read it, I was like, well, you should just start now because it doesn't matter. As long as you're growing, you're going to keep learning, right?
Get out of the calculator. Okay, so what else are we missing here? Yeah, so people are worried about over-emailing. I mean, every time we do a thing about emailing.
That's funny. As I got a text from Dave.
Yeah, Dave Senegal is always like, email the fuck out of them, right? So, but a lot of people don't want to do that. Like, what is a good barometer of how do you know when you're bugging people too much?
Right, and Lisa brought this question up because there's a brand within our group that will remain nameless that she liked their product but emailed her too much and she had to get off. So she doesn't want to be her own kind of case study like that.
I mean, once your unsubscribe rate is higher and getting higher, that's a pretty good indicator. And always have a preference center. Always give people the option to receive less emails instead of unsubscribing. That's huge.
Preference center.
And make it easy to do.
Yeah. Like instead, like when people click unsubscribe, sometimes you might want to just send them to a preference center where instead of just unsubscribing, they can also say, hey, I just want to receive your email biweekly or once a month, or I just want your monthly roundup, or I just want your discounts, or I just want your product launches, you know?
You have one where you just click, I just want the good ones?
Yeah.
That'd
be really funny.
I don't know if you can share it after. It'd be cool for the post notes. If you have any, because I've had a really hard time with the preference centers being done well. If you have any examples of that, I think would be really useful.
And I actually have a super random but very effective nugget. Is something we tested was when people unsubscribe on the thank you for unsubscribing page, we actually give them a discount. And it's so counterintuitive because in my head, I'm like, why would anyone unsubscribe and then go purchase with the discount you gave them? But lo and behold, you make quite a bit of money with that. So
wow, that's a great idea.
Genius.
Yeah.
I like it. It's because it's counterintuitive. It's great.
That's good. You also have something you talked about. With calendars, like, why don't you mention that tidbit too?
Which one about the calendar?
But before we started the call, we were asking about some cool stuff, and it sounds like you did something cool with calendar invites.
Oh yeah,
Jeff did that.
So my creative director, he's like a wild card. I love him. He's like, why don't we try, like, we're doing this product, having an add to calendar. So we have like an add to Google, add event to Google Calendar, and also add event to Apple Calendar email that goes out like 1 or 2 days before the launch. And it literally adds like the calendar for like, you know, Baby Bath Water product launch at like 10 a.m. tomorrow onto people's calendar. And I was like, I guess, like, I mean, I'm always up for testing, but there's no way this works. It just seemed very like irritating to people. That teaser email crushes it from a revenue standpoint. We've seen it do better than some actual launch emails. Then also it's boosted the launch email performance a ton as well. And then the calendar invite just has like the brand name, the launch, and then the link to the product for when it does launch. And I am still consistently blown away by how consistent, like every client we've launched it for, it wins every single time. Super high engagement rates, super high click rates, high revenue.
Quick tactical question. Did you use just like a Google Calendar or the add to calendar that then goes to all three? Or what was the tactical way you implemented the calendar?
So I don't actually know how it's done. There's like, there's two buttons. So it's like the add to Google Calendar and add to Apple Calendar. And then it's like custom coded. And then it downloads as an event. So like, if you click it, it opens up a Google Calendar link with the event pre-populated. And then you need to click add.
Yeah, I've been into those before and it works. It's funny because Leanna Patch, I saw her post on Instagram today. There's only one rule. If it's not on my calendar, it's not real. And then when you mentioned that, I was like, oh, you just took me to the most intimate thing that controls my hours of my day and put a marketing message into it.
I was like, if we feel like SMS is intrusive, I feel like this is like extra intrusive, but people love it. So if it keeps working. We've never got complaints. Like it doesn't spur any customer service issues. It just seems like a clean win across the board.
It's good for probably replenish stuff too. Imagine like putting the calendar for when you need to reorder.
Oh my god, that's amazing. I love that. I didn't even think of that.
You know, you tell them to do anything. It'd be like this, take a break on us. Like this is an hour break in your day. Sponsored by us. Like don't do anything.
Right. If you have like a meditation app or something, like, you know,
here's your hour break, right?
That's smart.
Oh, open column, you know, which on the other side, on the heady side is the funny side. I always like funny stuff. And even I think it's underused, like one of my favorite. We used to have a bunch of daily deal sites when someone unsubscribed.
This recording is a small sample of the many trainings and resources available to those in the Baby Bath Water membership community. This community isn't for everyone, but it might be for you. If you'd like to get involved, visit babybathwater.com.